ॐ ज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानञ्जनशलाकाय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः.
Although this world seems stable and our place here seems permanent, it's not. And we're on borrowed time. In fact, it's a miracle how things hold together at all. And at the same time, that miracle is Krishna. He's Otam Protam. Yata Kantapata Sutra Otaprotas Chasamstitaha Evam Vishnavidam Vishnu Otam Protam Chasamstitam. You know that verse? Otam Protam are the vertical and horizontal threads that go into a cloth. If you go to Mayapur and you go to the hand loom section where the devotees are actually making cloth by hand, you'll see that they stand at a loom and they actually weave together the cloth. So there's the Otam and the Protam. So Krishna is the Otam and the Protam. And in the Brahma Samhita, Eko Pyasaura Charitum Jagadanda Kotim Yash Shakti Rasti Jagadanda Chayayaranta Andantarasta Paramanu Chayantarastam Govindamari Purusham Tamaham Bhajam. He's an undifferentiated entity. He's multidimensional, unlimitedly dimensional. In other words, he's fully complete there within every atom. And he's the one who's maintaining and sustaining the universe and every living entity within it. Interesting around this time of year to observe how the animals start getting thicker fur. Who thought of that? It just happens automatically. They get thicker fur. And then there's winter fruits that come out, like the persimmon, even though, of course, it's California. The little squirrels have it pretty easy here. They should just get a pair of sunglasses. They can hang out. But you notice that the world's going on, and it's under control. Krishna's supplying every living entity. Nityo nityanam chetanas chetananam eko bahunam yo viditati kama. This verse from the Vedas is very reassuring, actually. One can take shelter in this, that there's one supreme eternal and there's a plurality of dependent eternals. And that one supreme eternal is maintaining all the others. He can do it. And one need only depend on him. We're dependent anyway, but it's a matter of coming to the realization and surrendering and taking shelter of Krishna's arrangement. All that I said by way of indicating that we're dependent on Krishna, and the material nature is also unpredictable. The Vedas, specifically the Bhagavatam, says padam padam yadvi padam, that there's danger at every step here. So don't take it for granted. The lifespan we have is not guaranteed. There's no guarantee that you get to live till 87 or 92 or whatever you might think is probably you're going to be your lifespan, or whatever the actuary table tells you. It can be at any moment. So we should take advantage of the time that we have. If we realize that our time is limited, then we get the advantage of forced efficiency in life. If I think I'll live forever, then I may put things off. But if I realize that every day counts, then I'll make the most of it. And that is a good segue into the topic that I'm going to present over the next 3 days, which is about powerful sadhana and what it is. First of all, the topic is extremely exciting because human beings, and that's who we are, have the ability to perform sadhana. Sadhana means practice, and from sadhana you reach the sadhya, which means the goal. And we have the intelligence and the freedom to perform practice, to discipline ourselves in any area that we like, and to improve. It only takes knowledge and practice to improve. And there's something magical about practice, that if one practices under guidance and diligently and does it carefully or as perfectly as possible and starts slowly, then one can improve in any area in life. And this is true in spiritual life too, which is the most important kind of practice that we can perform, because the human body, which is even more important than the demigod's body, is specifically meant for this kind of practice, to improve oneself spiritually and to rise above the impulses of the lower self and to become situated in steady remembrance of Krishna. And that can be achieved step by step through this practice of devotional service. There are three words that Prabhupada uses throughout his teachings to describe good or powerful sadhana, and they all begin with S. What are they? Strict is one, serious is the second, and sincere. My good friend Shrutadeva Prabhu pointed this out to me several years ago. He said, you know, I looked throughout Prabhupada's books and I found that he uses these three words, not together, but here, there, and everywhere. And putting them together, sadhana should be strict, serious, and sincere. So thinking about these words will inspire the mind and direct our practice. So what is strictness? The definition of strictness, it means, it's from Latin, to tighten or draw tight, not allowing deviation or relaxation of rules or discipline. And in the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita, Anjalila, 6th chapter, 309th verse, the practice of Raghunath Das Goswami is described as Pashanera Rekha. What does Pashanera Rekha mean? Shamalangi. Lines on stone. Okay. So Rekha means a line and Pashanera means a stone. So think about a stone and you make a line in the stone and that's it. It's there. And this is the description of the strict nature of Raghunath Das Goswami's sadhana, that it was like lines and stone. So thinking about his strict religious principles and how to get them like lines and stone. One point is, Prabhupada said that drops a day wear the stone away. And of course, when one starts off in any practice, one may be shaky. And there's a way in which there are maybe other interests and one's not completely set in the time and the manner of doing the practice. But as one continues and comes to the point of steadiness, then there's a way in which that practice wears a line in the stone of our life and it becomes part of our everyday existence. For some people, chanting 16 rounds is a high hill to climb. For others who have been doing it for a long time, it's life itself. It's something that one cannot do without. It's as natural as breathing. And for those who are used to taking prasadam, it's the most natural and joyful process in the world. It takes others some time to grasp it or to come into the kind of association that will allow them to take only Krishna prasadam and so forth. And in the Brahma Samhita, when the Lord is instructing Brahma, he says, by slow degrees, one can come to the point of perfection in one's practice. But we can think about strictness in our practice because the mind has a tendency to be whimsical and want to wander off. After a few days of strict practice, then the mind might say, well, let's take a break now. Of course, that may be part of one's strict practice, a way in which one affords the mind enough leeway so that it doesn't rebel. In the 11th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Krishna describes to Uddhava the perils of trying to over-control the mind at first. For instance, he describes how the tongue is so difficult to control that sometimes people take extreme measures like fasting for a long time. But then after they finish fasting, the tongue comes back and eats twice as much as it did before to try to make up for it. I deserve this! And there it comes. And in one place, Krishna describes how controlling the senses is like riding a horse and taming a horse. And in the beginning, one must give the horse some reins and then at other times pull them in. And it takes a little bit of skill in doing that so that one doesn't over-discipline the horse and then he'll buck you off his back and so forth. But strictness is an ideal that we should come to in our own practice. And the idea of having at least the basic practices like lines in stone. Certain things we don't do without, no matter what happens. There may be a flood, there may be a hurricane. The IRS may be knocking on the front door, but I still finish my rounds. And I still read my chapter of Bhagavad Gita. The basic principles that I do every day, I'm strict about. And I do those carefully. The next word, serious, from Latin, which means earnest. And we can also say an element of that is thoughtfulness. That one must be thoughtful in one's practice. Tachchadadhana munayo jnana vairagya yuktaya pashyantyatmani chatmanam bhaktya shuta grihitaya. This verse from the second chapter of the Bhagavatam, 14th verse, describes how a serious student on the path of bhakti. Can we give seats to all the guests who are coming in and also move the chairs out of the way so if they're sitting behind the chairs, they can see? Somebody, thank you. And welcome to everybody who's joined us online tonight also. Good to see you all. That one must fortify oneself with the practice of bhakti. In fact, the acharyas describe this verse as being indicative of the fact that if one is practicing bhakti, then naturally jnana and vairagya will come. We don't have to endeavor separately for them. But also, one must be thoughtful in one's practice. Think about what you're doing and be serious about it, because after being thoughtful, one may realize that this is the most important thing that I can do today. There are many obligatory activities that I may perform, taking care of the body in certain ways, and maybe I have to work, and I maybe have to maintain others. But I should be thoughtful about the fact that unless I fortify myself with very serious practice of bhakti, I won't have the wherewithal to take care of others, the potency to do that. So one should be serious and a couple of other definitions of serious in the dictionary are demanding careful application. This is a definition of seriousness. One who demands careful application. Also, substantial in terms of size, number, or quality. This also applies to serious practice of sadhana bhakti, that there should be enough quantity and quality so that it has enough of an influence that we can overcome the waves of the material desire and other kinds of distractions that come. In fact, Prabhupada mentions in talking about chanting, for instance, that there's this nambala, and he describes of a numerical strength. Of course, the quality is very, very important in chanting, but it's also important to maintain a certain number every day, and this develops what we call numerical strength. The mind may not be interested in chanting, for instance, japa. However, if I'm serious, I understand that the quantity is important even if I don't have a taste for it. I make the quantity anyway. I complete 16. If you're counting on your fingers, it's 1,725. And the number is important because by maintaining the quantity, it gives enough exposure so that I can begin to feel the effects of the practice. And that is important to maintain on a regular basis. So again, in seriousness, we have thoughtfulness. I should consider why I'm doing this, why it is I'm practicing. Reconsider how important it is that I learn to discipline the mind and that I get a taste from chanting and from hearing. And again, Shravanam Kirtanam are the staples of devotional practice. And as they say on Wall Street, you never go broke taking a profit. So if you're hearing and chanting, you're okay. Keep the vibration going. Stay in that as long as you can, and then develop a serious practice that includes a fixed number, a quality control that is going on regularly. That means it's substantial. And also be demanding of the careful application. This is seriousness. And sincerity. Sincerity is such a powerful substance. As I've mentioned before, if you go to Chandi Chowk in Old Delhi, you can go to Gulab Singh, who sells essential oils from all over the world. And he has some oils that will cost you $15,000 for a tiny little tola collected from the nether regions of the earth. And he sells to big companies who will come and buy a small quantity, and then they dilute it and they use it in thousands of gallons of other kinds of perfumes and things like that. However, if you go and ask him for a bottle this big of sincerity, or even one drop of pure sincerity, and you offer to pay him $1 million, he won't be able to deliver. It is the most valuable substance for spiritual practice that there is. And if you can get one drop of pure sincerity, then you're protected. Because Krishna knows the heart of every living entity, and when that sincerity appears, even externally the person may be flailing and unable to maintain a steady practice, still Krishna will help that person from within the heart. Another may be externally well situated, apparently, as Prahlad Maharaj mentions in his prayers to Lord Nrsingadev. Manye dana bijanara rupa tapa sutaujas teja prabhava bala paurusha buddhi yoga narada nai hi bhavanti parasipungso bhaktya tutosha bhagavan gaja yutapaya. He's thinking about what is his qualification for practicing devotional service. And he starts naming the qualities of people who have more expertise than he does. So he says, manye dana bijana. Some people may have a great wealth. They may have beauty. They may be able to perform great austerities, great learning. And he goes on with a long list of material qualities. And then he says that I don't have any of these qualities, and therefore, how can I perform devotional service? And then he remembered, Bhaktya tutosha bhagavan gajayutapaya, that Gajendra was an elephant. What was his qualification? But he pleased Krishna, even though he was an elephant, just by a little sincere prayer, and he attained perfection. And in the Padyavali, there's a long verse that lists all of the apparently unqualified personalities who attained perfection by pleasing the Lord, even though they were animals, even though they were ugly. Like Kubja was not beautiful. She was a hunchback. She was ugly. But somehow or other, she pleased Krishna. And then what good are long bouts of meditation for her or any kind of practice of mystic yoga? Absolutely unimportant. But because she was able to somehow or other, through her sincerity, please Krishna, she attained perfection. Goes on to name Hanuman, who was a monkey from the forest, and many other personalities who apparently had no external qualification, but because they had that one tiny molecule of sincerity, they pleased Krishna. And if you can do that, then everything else becomes perfect. That's the goal. And if you don't do that, then it doesn't matter what else you do. Your endeavors are not considered very important. In fact, in the next verse, he mentions that a person may be a Brahmin with all the brahminical qualifications, but if he's averse to devotional service and Krishna, then that person can't purify himself and he can't purify others also. Whereas a person who's from a low family, from a background where one may say he has no qualification whatsoever in brahminical culture, a shwapacha, a dog eater by birth, if he is a devotee and he pleases Krishna, then he can not only purify himself, his whole family, he can purify the whole world because of that quality. So sincerity also is mentioned, or we can allude to from the verse, Tesham satata yuktanam bhajatam priti purvakam dadami buddhi yogam tam yenamam upayanti te. One of the most frequently quoted verses in Prabhupada's purports. And he uses it in many different ways, but typically he talks about how a person who is sincere in devotional service will be directed by Krishna from within the heart, because that's what the verse says. That if a person has a little bit of sincerity or has some affection for Krishna and tries, then Krishna gives intelligence from within the heart how to proceed in devotional service. So strict, serious, and sincere. These are three words that go with our sadhana, our practice of sadhana bhakti. Strict, serious, and sincere. Ramanand Sakarprabhu.
Regarding those who meditate on Krishna, and comparing them with Kubja, how can we say that those who are meditating on Krishna for a long time?
I was talking about the mystic meditation process.
Okay.
And there's in the comparison that is given in the Shastra. In fact, it's in a purport written by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur in the Chaitanya Bhagavat. He's referring to those who are performing impersonal meditation. And in fact, the importance of one's state of heart and one's practice comes out very beautifully in a story in the Chaitanya Bhagavat about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu at Srivasangam. And his dancing was so spectacular, it's mentioned in the Chaitanya Bhagavat, that everyone wanted to see us dancing. But for a year, the devotees kept the doors of Srivasangam locked. And only the pure devotees, the most intimate disciples, followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, could come in and perform kirtan and watch the Lord dance. And then one day, a young Brahmin, who was very austere, brahmachari, approached Srivas Thakur and said, "I really want to see the Lord dance. Could I please come in? Somehow bring me in." And he said, "I only drink milk. I don't take anything else." And Srivas thought, yes, this is very austere brahmachari. He only drinks milk. He can come in. So he brought him in and he put him in a secret place so he could watch the dancing. And Mahaprabhu began dancing in the kirtan, and then he stopped. He said, "I don't feel the usual ananda in this dancing, in this kirtan. Some impure person is in here." He said, no impure person is known. "Some other person's in here." He said, "Only a brahmachari. And he's very special. He only drinks milk." "Only drinks milk! That's no qualification to come in here." Mahaprabhu became furious. And he said that there's no material qualification, some austerity. In fact, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur explains in this context that the Brahmin was a little proud. He was thinking that, "I'm very austere, I only drink milk." This can happen when people perform austerities. They can start thinking, "I'm better than others because they don't quite wake up as early as I do." Or other considerations like that. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu understood the heart of this Brahmin, that he was a little proud. And also to make a point to his devotees that there was no material qualification for being in the association of the devotees and seeing Mahaprabhu. So he ordered, "Throw him out." And this brahmachari, in his heart, began to appreciate deeply the chastisement he received from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He was thinking, "How wonderful it is that I've now been chastised by Mahaprabhu himself. How fortunate am I?" And he also thought that, you know, I was a little puffed up. So he gave up immediately his conceited ideas about only drinking milk. And then he thought, "And if nothing else happens in my life, at least I already saw Mahaprabhu dance. It's too late." And he was deeply appreciating like that. And just because Mahaprabhu is the super soul within everyone's heart, as he was pushing him away, he realized what was the nature of the heart of this person and how he had instantly been transformed. And then he called him back and he embraced him. And he gave him benedictions, and all the devotees embraced him, and he became a recognized devotee. And so the state of heart of the devotee is important, that molecule of sincerity, of appreciation, no matter what one's external condition or circumstance is of utmost importance. So that sincerity must be there, strict, serious, and sincere. And of course, the strictness and the seriousness comes out when we have this sincerity in our heart. In the beginning, there's a way in which, Prabhupada says in the Bhagavad Gita, we may not be able to fully discharge devotional service, but any advanced devotee can tell when somebody's really trying. And obviously, Krishna can tell when somebody's really trying to improve themselves and to do better. And that's all that's necessary if one's sincere and one's trying to improve. And at the end of every day, we can analyze, how did I do today? I fell short in so many ways. And let me try again tomorrow and improve my practice tomorrow. So if we keep on these points of strict, serious, and sincere devotional service, then we will be on the right track for our practice. Another very important aspect of devotional practice, and actually this applies to any practice in life, but very specifically it's mentioned in regards to devotional practice, is our orbit. What is our orbit? And you change your orbit, you change your life. Everyone has an orbit. Just notice the way you drive home from your work today. Is it the same as it was yesterday? Do you take a different route every day? You do? You usually take the same route home? Do you do other things on a regular basis? Like wake up at the same time, go to sleep at the same time, generally? If you notice, there's a way in which human beings tend to get in an orbit. And they have a certain kind of association. That determines how we're moving in our own life. In fact, in Jyotish, there's a description of the planets within the universe, which is what Jyotish is, a rendering of the configuration of planets and how they affect us. And each one of the planets is actually a person with potencies, and that's why we're affected in various ways, because of our proximity, according to the time we're born, and the latitude, longitude, and so forth. And these planets are called grahas. Graha means grabbers. They're little grabbers. They color the way we see the world. They grab us and they move us in a certain direction. And people everywhere are also little grabbers. Everyone you meet is a graha, a little grabber. Everyone in your orbit, in your family, in your office, and whatever, look around your life and see who are the little grabbers in your life. They're pulling you in a certain direction. And therefore, association is vitally important. How we organize ourselves and what kind of association we keep will determine the direction we're going. So it's an orbit. The people we're around, they keep us in a certain orbit. They keep us going in a certain way. And notice it is an orbit. Like planets, they stick in a certain orbit. They don't move. They're fixed in that. So we're like that also. But you can't change your orbit by changing your association deliberately. And by seeking good association and taking advantage of good association, which is an art, and which is part of the practice of bhakti, or the greatest part of the practice of bhakti, how to take advantage of good association, will determine our orbit. So change your orbit, change your life. I was thinking in those terms of how even a little change in orbit can affect us. If the sun moves an inch one way or the other, we'll either freeze or we'll burn up in a second. So slight change in orbit can make a big difference. You don't have to change everything, but if you change slightly, it will have a major effect on your life. Illustrating that point, Srila Prabhupada once talking to his disciple Prajapati on a morning walk in Venice Beach, California, told his disciple, Srila Prabhupada told his disciple that advancement in devotional service is dependent on association. He gave the example of someone becoming a drunkard. And he said, how do you become a drunkard? You go and associate with those who are addicted to drinking. And you sit with them, and then they'll teach you how to drink and get drunk and fall down and wake up somewhere else and get some money and do it again. It's a way of life. And He said, if you associate in that way, then you also become a drunkard. So he said, if you want to become a devotee, then associate with those who are pure devotees. And they'll also teach you how to become a pure devotee. And you'll change your orbit and change your life. Prajapati said, so Prabhupada, I think you want us to become drunkards on the holy name. He's very dramatic. He's an actor. Prabhupada, you want us to become drunkards on the holy name? Prabhupada said, yes. But it's very practical. And you can notice it and should notice it that your association has a profound effect on your consciousness and the way that you move in the world. Now, regarding practice, it requires some impetus. And as we've said before, your attention will follow your intention. Both words have the root ten, which means to connect, like tendon. Your tendons connect. What do they connect, Nirgula?
Muscle to bone.
Tendons connect muscle to bone. So they hold it together pretty well, too, tendons. So that's ten. So intention. What do you intend to do? That's a connecting point. I intend to go to, and then once you intend to go there, you're going to go. You'll figure out a way to move in that direction. And once your intention is fixed, then your attention will follow. You'll attend to it. Your consciousness will go there also. And where attention goes, energy flows. So these are important to remember in practice, that your intention must be clear. Why are you doing this? Do you intend to do it or not? If you intend to do something, even if someone tries to stop you, you'll do it anyway. That's the point. If your intention is very clear, that even though there are obstacles, you'll do it anyway, because that's what you intend to do. And if you don't intend to do it, if your intention is something different, if you have an ulterior motive, for instance, then you may go somewhere, you may have all the tools necessary, you may have all the money in the world, but you won't do it because you don't intend to do it. But if you don't have any facility, but you have the intention, then you have everything necessary to move forward. If you have intention, your attention will follow. So if you intend to practice each day, for instance, in one given morning, if you intend to chant your mantras with gusto and strictly and seriously and sincerely, and you've fixed your intention, then your attention will come back to that point over and over again. So fix your intention. And God helps those who help themselves. This is an old saying. And Prabhupada once said, helping oneself means putting oneself in front of transcendental sound vibration. You have to at least do that. I mean, there's libraries all over America, right? How many people have a library card? Good for you. I like this group. How many people do you think in America have a library card? Not that many. It's a very civilized thing, libraries. I mean, it's just there, it's free, and all the knowledge in the world available. But who takes advantage of it? I'm too busy. I'm doing something else. In other words, everything we need is actually available, but whether or not I take advantage of it is my business. And this is the determination of a sadhaka, that Krishna has given me ample opportunity. I see this oftentimes. I read something where it said someone was complaining about their shoes until they saw someone that had no feet. But I've seen in devotees who are very determined, who had much less, apparently, you know, facility than me. For instance, I know one devotee that I'm corresponding with who was born in a devotee family. She became paralyzed, quadriplegic when she was just young. And since then, her arms and legs don't work. That's what quadriplegic means, in a wheelchair. And she sent me for my birthday a painting that was one of the most exquisite paintings I've ever seen. And I asked one of her friends, I said, she made this? They said, yeah. She said, how did she do it? She painted it with her mouth. I mean, it's a beautiful oil painting. And it also has along the border a Sanskrit verse written in perfect Sanskrit and so forth. Done. She holds the paintbrush in her mouth. And in corresponding with her, she tells, she was saying that, you know, she feels very fortunate because people are walking here and there and doing all kinds of things. But she said, Krishna gave me an opportunity to sit this one out in this lifetime. And no sense of remorse, but only determination in her practice and devotional service. And observing how in any circumstance, a devotee who is determined, whose intention is strong. See, some devotees, a devotee I'm corresponding with who's in jail for life with no possibility of parole. That means he's behind bars until the end of this natural life and very determined in his devotional service. And he recently was, he's been reading and reading and reading and studying. And the letters he writes are very powerful, sincere, motivated in devotional his devotional practice, despite the circumstances there. And he wanted to know about how to perform archan, how to do deity worship. And so he was trying very hard. It's hard to get anything when you're in prison, but he wanted to get paraphernalia for performing deity worship. So all he could come up with for an Achman cup was a styrofoam cup and a spork. A spork is a spoon and a fork combined, because that's what they give you in, in prison, apparently. And fully intended, in whatever way he could, to figure out how to worship the deity, even though he doesn't have a deity, and even though he doesn't have any paraphernalia. So I sent him the story from the Nectar of Devotion about the Brahmin from Jyotishtapur, who was very poor, but he was going to lectures about devotional service and archan. And in one of the lectures, the speaker said that if you don't have any paraphernalia, you can do everything by meditation. And this Brahmin began performing his worship of the deity through meditation. And every day he would relish sitting down and elaborately putting out all the paraphernalia and then going through all the process of deity worship in his mind. And he would go to the Ganga, the Jamuna, the Saraswati, collect the water in gold pots and bring it back for the deity and so forth. And every day he was cooking sweet rice. And he would, in his meditation, make sure that the sweet rice had cooled down, because the cooler the sweet rice when it's served, the better it is. So one day in his meditation, his timing was a little off, and he had made the sweet rice in meditation, but he wasn't sure if it cooled down enough to offer to the Lord. So then he touched with the tip of his finger to see if it had cooled down enough, and it was still so hot it burned his finger. And as soon as he burned his finger, he woke from his meditation, and he looked at his finger, and his finger was burnt. And as described in the Shastra, Lord Narayan was observing this, and he began to, out of appreciation, chuckle. And Lakshmi Devi said, why are you laughing? And then Lord Narayan sent a Vaikuntha airplane to pick up this Brahmin and bring him back. My point in these stories is that external facility is not important. Or it's important in as much as we use it fully, but the essence of our progress depends on our own intention and our determination within our heart to steadily, according to our ability, do everything we can to practice chanting, practice hearing, and slowly, step by step, this constant practice with determination will inspire the devotee by instilling a higher taste. In other words, Krishna will give a higher taste. And there's a reality that awakens in the devotee's mind and heart and sees that there's a difference between the spiritual world and the material world. There's a difference between me and my body. And as the Bhagavatam says, there's a progression in which the devotee scientifically realizes the truth. It's no longer a theory, but he actually sees it for himself. And the Vedas describe this like waking up from a dream. And ultimately, as Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, we're covered by ignorance. But as that ignorance dissipates by the process of transcendental sound vibration, then we see everything. In fact, Narada says in the fifth chapter of the Bhagavatam, first canto, that when he became advanced in devotional service, he could understand that he was the same quality as the Lord. Of course, he's an eternal servant, but he could see he was also transcendental. He had nothing to do with the material modes of nature and all of the activities here. So this is an introduction to the process of sadhana. And there are five elements that we're going to talk about over the next few days, next 2 days, in the practice of strong sadhana. And these five elements are as follows. One, it is performed, that is, strong sadhana, colon, is performed with the proper attitude. Two, it is regular. Three, it is attentive. Four, it is goal-oriented. And five, it is done according to one's personal capacity. So we'll talk about these five elements over the next couple of days and go into depth on each one of them. And now, since we have just a few minutes left, let's see if there are any reflections or questions. Yes. Hare Krishna.
That's not, it's about Krishna, but not really tied into your wonderful lecture.
Well, then let's wait.
Okay.
See if there's something related to the lecture.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you, Guru Maharaj, for a wonderful class. And first point you make mention about the strict sadhana. Sometimes, like, you wanted to strict sadhana, but because of family situations, like, that doesn't allow, then how to do that? Like, suppose a small example, like utensils, we know that we should not mix it, but someone is not cooperating with you and your family, and then how it helps?
You do the best you can with what you have. Try doing archana with a spork. See how that works out for you. And being in a federal penitentiary for the rest of your life. I mean, can you do devotional service in jail? Absolutely. Can you do it anywhere? Yes. There's no material impediment. So whatever situation you're in now, do the best you can. And in fact, sometimes it's Krishna's arrangement. When you get put into a situation where there's outsiders and you have to perform your devotional service and you go on with it anyway, it'll affect them in a profound way. I still remember that when I didn't visit my parents for about, I don't remember, 8 years or something like that after I joined the movement, because I became a brahmachari and was averse to coming home. But when I finally did, I brought my Shalagram Shila. I was on my way to India, and I would worship my, do my puja in the house, kind of secretly, but then I'd bring all the paraphernalia out, and I'd be washing it, and my mother would go, wow, that's pretty interesting stuff. What is that? And that good, that smells really good and everything. And then for years later, she would say, you know, I just remember all that, you know, Krishna really smells good, all this good smelling stuff. And that there are other devotees who have told me that they have gone into environments where they didn't have very much facility, but they'd go off every day and chant their rounds. And then their relatives, Arusha just told me this, she had to go off to attend to her father who was ill, and then she was with her family, and then, you know, she just went about chanting her japa sort of privately, but after a while, everyone kept asking, where are you going? What are you chanting? We want to know. You show us how to do this, and so forth. So do the best you can with what you have, and it'll affect others also. Yes.
Hare Krishna. So this is a question regarding the two words that you emphasized on, strictness and quality. So the question is, you know, how do we strike balance between these two? Because oftentimes, right, I find myself in a situation where I'm so focused on getting my rounds done, right, that I get
it. Quantity and quality?
Yes. So, I mean, I get the rounds done no matter what, but then the quality takes a dip, you know, suffers. So
you have to balance, and a balance means that balancing takes a little time when you're going like this, right? Because when you first start to balance, like that. So one thing you can remember is, in one way, quantity is quality because there's numerical strength. So don't think that just because, you know, you're doing a certain number, it's not quality. There is a quality in that that's very powerful, and the quantity, and the quality also, you have to keep bringing back to it being attentive. And that's where the real quality comes in, when there's good attention. And so that you have to keep checking yourself on, and that's what yoga means, to control the mind. You have to constantly check your mind and see where it went and bring it back, and then put it back on the mantra. Yes, Shalabahu.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. My question is, you were mentioning that we need to change the orbits. When we change the orbits, actually we are kind of losing the steadiness and the balance. How do we, would you mind to elaborate a little more about that?
Well, mainly when I'm talking about changing your orbit, I'm talking about who you associate with. So if you can extend yourself to good to those who are advanced in devotional service, this is changing your orbit. Make arrangements to be around those who are steady and advanced in devotional service. And then it becomes more and more of a regular habit. And as it does, your life will change just by that change in orbit. And as you take on new association, the other association won't become as important. It's just natural. That's what I meant. One last. Yes.
So changing the orbit means changing association, so you said. But what does it actually mean, Prabhu? Because I spend 8 hours at work and 2 hours driving. So we hardly, in a week, maybe 2-3 hours, not even consistent or focused association. So what does it mean to be in a pure association?
A little bit goes a long way. And it means that wherever you're, whatever situation you're in now, when you get an opportunity, take advantage of it, because it will expand. You may think you don't have much of an opportunity. That's what most people think. And then if you take advantage of whatever opportunities you do get, it'll open the pathway for you to do more devotional service just by association. Therefore, the Shastra says that even a fraction of a moment of association with a sadhu can really change your life, your attitude, your heart, everything, your practice. And as you continue doing that, it becomes a pattern. And you may only be touching that association infrequently, but as you continue to do it, it becomes a part of your regular orbit, and your life will change over time. You're not going to be working the same number of hours your whole life, I guarantee you. Things change. I mean, it's the nature of the world. Interesting point about, the world's disintegrating before our eyes. In reading the Tattvasandarbha recently, we were reading about the four different kinds of destruction, pralaya, that Jiva Goswami mentions. One happens at the end of Brahma's life, one happens at the end of Brahma's day. And then there's one he calls continuous devastation. So what is this continuous devastation? And it wasn't mentioned in the abstract, but later on we were reading, there it is. Continuous destruction means that everything in the universe is falling apart at every minute. It's all coming apart before our eyes. We're permanent because we're spiritual, but the energy around us is constantly changing and moving. So if you take advantage of the small opportunities that you have, then you can be sure that the other aspects of your life are going to change and fall apart. But that part will become a permanent asset, because when you get good association and perform devotional service, it's never lost. So we'll continue the topic on Saturday morning at 7:30 a.m. and also on Sunday coming up at 4 o'clock p.m. and talk more in detail about these aspects of strong sadhana and what it is. And we'll continue to apply it in our lives and make progress. Thank you. Hare Krishna. We're going on with the process of devotional service as it's been passed down through the great acharyas. We are following Krishna's advice in the Bhagavad Gita, acharyopasanam, which is to follow the great souls, those who are self-effulgent, who have set the pace in devotional service, who have heard directly from Krishna or from his empowered representatives and passed down that message. Through the ages, one can actually find solace in that message itself. No matter where one is or what situation one's in, the potency is self-evident just as much as when one's hungry and eats food, one feels nourished, satisfied, and the hunger goes away. Similarly, the process of devotional service is natural because it is inherent within the heart of every living being to love, especially love the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Somehow we're out of kilter here in the material world. Somehow or other, we've come under the influence of the external energy of the Lord, which is a third-class kind of energy. No one likes third-class stuff these days. And the energy of the material world is Krishna's separated energy. We are part of the superior energy, and we belong to that category. And we actually have a choice whether to live in the inferior energy or to elevate ourselves to the external position, to the higher position of the internal energy of the Lord. And that can be done through the process of bhakti yoga. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came little more than 500 years ago, 527 years, I think it's a couple weeks and a few days ago. He was just here. And he taught a system that is completely in line with the Vedic teachings. What are the Vedic teachings? They're very important because in this dark world, how do we get knowledge? If we try through our senses, we'll find that our senses mislead us because they can't show us exactly what we're looking at. They're dependent on higher powers like the demigods. Like the, if we don't have sunlight, we can't see anything. We can't see what's in the next room. We can't see what's on the back of our eyelid, for that matter. The eyes, the ears, the gyanendriyas, those senses we have that gather knowledge are imperfect. So we can't come to perfect knowledge. In order to be perfectly happy, we have to have perfect knowledge. And therefore, there is a source of pure perfect knowledge mentioned by the acharyas. There is the Vedas. The Vedas are co-eternal with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. They've always existed. They're always the same. They manifest from time to time in this world, and the Lord makes sure that they're available. And this is the preoccupation of his devotees, to also make sure that the Vedas are available, because from the Vedas come perfect knowledge. From that perfect knowledge, one can live the perfect lifestyle, be perfectly happy, and go back to home, back to Godhead at the end of this life. Without that, one lives in a suffering condition of life. The Vedas, however, are very difficult to understand. They're written in Sanskrit. They are, they must be precisely pronounced. And there are a lot of them. And it's hard to decipher them without expert training and guidance and beginning one's life at a very big, and beginning to studying them from early time in life. And therefore, in the Kali Yuga, Jiva Goswami points out that the itihasas, like Mahabharata, the Ramayana, and the Puranas complete the Vedas. Just as a gold bangle with a gap is filled in by the same quality gold, so similarly, the Puranas, the itihasas, are of the same quality as the Vedas. They are smriti, where they explain the Vedas. And Jiva Goswami goes further, and he points out that actually in the age of Kali Yuga, the itihasas and Puranas are even more important than the Vedas, because people can't understand the Vedas, but they can understand the itihasas and Puranas. Then there are Puranas that are in the mode of ignorance, mode of passion, mode of goodness. They cater to those various people in various stages of life. But out of all the Puranas, Jiva Goswami shows us that the Bhagavat Purana, the Srimad Bhagavatam, is the perfect Purana, the Amala Purana, and it is the highest authority on Vedic knowledge. It is the cream of all Vedic knowledge, Nigama Kalpataro Galitam Palam, the cream. And just by hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam, which, by the way, is 18,000 verses, but Jiva Goswami points out that there are other versions that have a billion verses. And I was thinking how we would get those in the door at somebody's apartment. So we're lucky, 18,000 verses. Within those 18,000 verses is the sound vibration, which is also eternal. The Srimad Bhagavatam is always the same, although it manifests through sages at various times. Those sages have posts and they bring out the Srimad Bhagavatam. The syllables are the same, although it may appear to have happened at a certain time in history. It's an eternal literature also. And just by hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam in the age of Kali, one can come to perfect knowledge of the spiritual world and one's relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Anything short of that will leave one unsatisfied, and also in that unsatisfied state with imperfect knowledge, one will tend to linger here in the material world, loiter, linger, wander, wend one's way through through various unfortunate circumstances. So we recommend, based on what we've been taught by the acharyas, that one regularly hear the Srimad Bhagavatam. Sanatana Goswami also points out in his Brihat Bhagavatamrita that even having physical contact with the Srimad Bhagavatam brings auspicity and purification in one's life. And just by hearing this literature regularly, the heart becomes clarified and one comes to perfect knowledge. And Whatever we hear about, we go for. That's the way it works in this world. If you hear about Honolulu, I don't know about Honolulu. I've heard it. I mean, if you hear about the Hawaiian Islands, for instance, we tell you it's much warmer over there than it is here. It stays about 72 degrees all year long. It's beautiful. The sun is shining. It smells like flowers all day long. I don't know how much description you need, but your mind sooner or later will start thinking, well, maybe let's see how much the tickets are. So similarly, the Srimad Bhagavatam is there, so we can hear it, and then we'll start thinking, well, maybe I won't stay here in the world of birth and death. Maybe I'll go back home, back to Godhead. And one will develop one's intense desire to be with Krishna. And the problem is, in the material world, no one knows who Krishna is. Everyone's forgotten, actually. And the problem is, no one got the memo. Everyone missed it. There's not enough information. There's not enough information. Therefore, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu told Sanatana Goswami, Maya Mukta Jivir Nahi Swata Krishna Gyan. It's not automatic that people will come out if they don't have the information. But then he said, out of mercy, Vyasadeva put down the Vedas. Interesting about Vyasadeva, Vyasadeva is a post, and Jivas take that post to bring down the Vedas. But in this age, Jiva Goswami says, our Vyasadeva is directly an incarnation of Narayan. We have a lot going for us. And the Srimad Bhagavatam, which he has rendered, comes from Samadhi Bhasha. It means he saw personally the personality of Godhead, his energies, the Jiva. Everything perfectly was revealed to him. That's how knowledge comes down. It's revealed through sages. That's how mantras come. Everything's passed down. So we are living off of that. And our institution exists simply to take the teachings of the great acharyas passed down to us, especially through our founder acharya, His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, who has brought us the perfect rendition of the Srimad Bhagavatam. He translated all the way up until the 13th chapter of the 10th canto before he left this world, and then his faithful disciples whom he trained, showing the efficacy of his teaching, were able to take up that work and complete the work itself and go on to bring other works like the Brihat Bhagavatamrita, Tattva Sandarbha, etc., into human society in a perfect way, following in the footsteps of Srila Prabhupada. So this is a live movement following in the footsteps of the acharyas. So we invite everybody to read the Srimad Bhagavatam on a regular basis. If you're feeling any pinprick of at all from living in this material world, anything? Or is it just me? Then read Srimad Bhagavatam. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught, chant Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna has everything. It is everything. It's Krishna himself. It's completely charming. If you're not feeling the charm of chanting Hare Krishna, just keep chanting. It's in there. And that's what all the Shastras are saying. It's in there. Just keep trying. Don't give up. Keep trying. The mind will say, well, what about cigarettes? They're pretty nice. What about, there's a long list of inferior items that line up in the mind, but keep chanting until it moves to the head of the list. And when nothing else will do except the chanting of the Holy Name, we know we're making advancement in spiritual life. And when nothing else will do but filling one's time, at least block out some time every day to read the Srimad Bhagavatam, then we know we're making advancement in spiritual life. And by the way, 18,000 verses has a certain number of pages which have been calculated by some of our expert mathematicians and engineers here at ISV. And if you read 41 pages of the Bhagavatam every day, you'll complete the entire book in 1 year. 41 pages only. And that only takes about 45 minutes to an hour a day, depending on how fast you read. And all you have to do is turn off everything with an on-off switch and tell everyone that you don't want to be bothered for at least an hour and read your 41 pages a day. And if you do that for 5 years, you'll have read the Bhagavatam 5 times, and I guarantee you, your life will change and your trajectory will change and you'll be on your way back home, back to Godhead. That's how easy this is. In another sense, it's not easy because the material energy has such a pull that it's difficult to get away. So start where you can. But take the process given by the acharyas, given by the most recent incarnation of Krishna, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself, with full gusto wherever you are, and you'll make advancement and go back home, back to Godhead, guaranteed. It's a very simple process in this age, and there's special mercy for everybody.
Nachari Armarman, Nachari Armarman, Nachari Armarman, Nachari Armarman, hey, Nachari Armarman, Nachari Armarman, Nachari Armarman, Nachari Armarman.